Unreal. Uncensored. Unradio. CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I am your host, Stilly Sharalambos. I am in studio with Simon Allison, otherwise known as the Alan Davies of the Daily Maverick Show, resident visitor to these parts. Looking at the lineup for today, unfortunately, looks like a hell of a lot of death, destruction, and just general malaise happening around the world. Looking at all the major news stories, unfortunately filled with violence almost in every which corner you look at.
And, another day at work, eh?
Yeah, and we were just discussing this off air, just seeming like South Africa seems to be in a slow news cycle compared to everything else that's going on. We've had things like the unluckiest airline in the world, Malaysian Airlines, losing another plane in this last week, and some interesting developments out of there, Simon.
Yeah, well, the world just feels sort of almost apocalyptic at the moment, doesn't it? Everything is going wrong.
And
yes, it just is this weird, eerie, grim feeling. I think people are really worried about this Malaysian thing because of the echoes that it has to what started the First World War. So there you had a separatist group in Eastern Europe who they shot at an archduke, and it was an act of violence. Franz Ferdinand, also a great band. So some good did come out of World War One. But now you have a similar thing. You have a separatist group in Eastern Europe committing an act of violence. And again, there's the situation where the great powers are ranged against each other. In one corner, you have the US and the UK and the European Union. In the other corner, you have the might of Russia. And there are question marks over where China stands in all this. But there is very much a sense that this could turn into a big the kind of global superpower tussle that we thought we'd put behind us with the end of the Cold War. My personal feeling is it's not going to happen. There are enough safeguards in place. I think the international community has come a long way in terms of how it deals with these crises. Also, the world's economies are so incredibly interconnected these days. So the amount of gas that Russia sells to Europe via Ukraine, it's huge. Huge volumes. They need that market. There are other markets, but that is an important market. And it's not just gas, of course. It's a lot of other things are going on. These days, the world is so interconnected that no major power can afford a war with another power.
And the prospect of a world war is absolutely scary and terrifying to think that we live in a day and age where that could happen. And I mean, we've always kind of thought, you know, that's never again. As you say, our economies are interconnected, too intertwined, too dependent on so many other factors. And, you know, also looking at the way that, you know, the Chinese have approached, you know, sort of territorial domination as well, it's easier and cheaper to just go in and buy the place.
Yes. You know,
I mean, isn't that really the approach that we should be taking here? It's actually cheaper than, you know, than running a martial economy for a couple of years and saying, well, okay, well, we'll just go in there and basically buy out, you know, the incumbents.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a much more sensible way. I mean, it's quite ironic that it takes the Chinese to point out the obvious capitalist approach to expanding territory. They have a few things to teach the Americans about capitalism. Yeah, so I'm not worried. I don't think that a third world war will break out. Having said that, if it does, South Africa's a pretty good place to be. I'm feeling happy right now that we're out on the arse end of the continent.
There are times when the arse end of Africa is a good place to be.
And we've become a lot less strategic than we used to be. Nowadays, people fly everywhere. Ships have enough fuel that they don't need to stop at the Cape of Good Hope to refuel. So really, we're just a little safe oasis in this great sea of violence and conflict that surrounds us.
And whilst we do obviously do a lot of trade with European partners and trade partners, and you know, we've been trying to expand the economy beyond our own, we are in many cases self-sustaining, and which has been a bad thing from a growth point of view. But when, you know, the crap hits the fan, that's, you know, it seems to be an umbrella we can hide under.
Well, the most important thing is we can feed ourselves. We have more than enough farmland to make the country go around, and that is ultimately the most key element for any society to survive in times of war like this.
There are a couple of interesting questions around the flight itself. You know, notably like why, you know, a plane was flying over what was potentially very dangerous airspace, you know. And as much as we like to think the separatists and the rebels, you know, would have, you know, the equipment and the tools to be able to, you know, identify commercial aircraft from something that isn't, you know, we can't always make those kind of assumptions. I mean, there's some very strange, very strange decisions were made to allow, you know, Malaysian Airlines to fly over that airspace.
If you look at it, I love those websites and apps where you can see a real time picture of all the planes in the air at the same time. There are a lot of planes in the air. The airspace of Earth is becoming really crowded, and what it means if you deviate from your air path, you know, the standard routes. They have these super aviation highways. If you deviate from them, you're going to add a lot of extra cost onto your journey. Every few minutes, either way, is petrol, is money, and they just can't afford to burn that. And the reality is, there's also a lot of conflict in the world. You know, if you're going to avoid every area where, you know, they've got a few people loosing off AK-47s, then it's going to be really hard to fly around this planet of ours. I remember just a few weeks ago when the ISIS, the Islamic State, as they're calling themselves now, they were advancing in northern Iraq, and I was flying between Istanbul and Doha. And we flew over Iraq. We flew over Kirkuk, which is the main Kurdish city up there north.
Yeah.
Fighting wasn't in Kirkuk, but it was close. Yeah. You know, we flew over the runway. I could see it. I was thinking to myself, well, this is crazy. I don't want to be in this airspace right now, because I know these guys have anti-aircraft weaponry, but it's still happening. No one's changed those flight paths. This event is just so completely unprecedented that it hadn't really been factored into civilian aviation calculations. It will now.
Yeah, it's probably a little bit clearer over the Ukraine in terms of flight path and traffic at the moment. If you'd like to call in and ask us a question, the number is 0861-555-189. That's 0861-555-189. Or get us on Twitter at cliffcentral.com or at Daily Maverick on Twitter. The other big news item that's been dominating headlines around the world is obviously the conflict in Gaza. We've seen, you know, things that we, you know, have been termed ceasefires, but have lasted literally hours, you know, before, you know, homemade rockets are being shot into Israeli parts of the country, and then we're seeing Israel coming down with the sledgehammer in Gaza and other Palestinian controlled areas. It's just, I had this conversation with Brooks last week on the show and the week before, and we were talking about it, and his sentiment was things need to get worse before they can get better, that people need to realize the cost of their approach at the moment, the stubborn approach from both sides is not going to get anyone anywhere, and only until they get worse and the costs get even higher are people going to be motivated to try and find a solution that, you know, gets them out of this situation.
There's only one side that can end this conflict, and it's not Palestine. Palestine has no cards. They have nothing. Israel, the power imbalance is so stark that in reality, Israel is the only side that has the means to bring about some kind of solution. The problem is they're not bearing any of the cost of this conflict. I think if you look at it, I mean, more than 600 people in Palestine have died. I think it's
soldiers or something is
yeah. And those soldiers only died because they were sent to attack inside Palestinian territory. It really is just such an unequal thing. We should talk about Gaza for a little bit.
Have you reported from Palestine,
yes,
Simon? You've actually been there.
I've been there. I couldn't get into Gaza. I wasn't allowed. I made the mistake of going with a photographer friend of mine, and we got to the border crossing. It was just 2 days after it had been opened for the first time in years. This was in 2009. And we rocked up at this border crossing. We put homemade TV stickers all over our car so they knew we were press. And we made the fatal mistake of noticing that there were bullet holes in the sort of plexiglass of the immigration booths. And you just wonder how on earth those got there. But we noticed that, and my friend, the photographer, took a picture.
Right.
And that was a bad move.
Yeah.
So sure enough, we were taken off into a side room. Took all our clothes off. They sent our bags through. some things I'd rather not talk about on air. Thank you. But it was, yeah, you know, so
I'm sure,
it was
a very
was
scary.
Scary
situation, right?
But, you know, the thing I got from that is just the physical space. And this is what people who haven't been there don't really understand, that Gaza is a little strip of land. On the one side is water. Mm-hmm. So you can't really go anywhere, especially because there's a couple of great big Israeli frigates preventing boats from going too far out. Then on the southern border, you've got Egypt. Egypt is... Under the Muslim Brotherhood last year, Egypt started opening up that border. They started to let goods and people pass back and forward. One guy in Gaza was doing a great business delivering KFC from the nearest Egyptian town, you know. You'd phone him, place your order. Yeah. He'd, like, go in his motorbike, and then 3 hours later, your congealed chicken would arrive. And then on the other border, all the other borders... are Israeli. So all the land borders of Gaza, it's not a border in the conventional sense. It's a wall.
It's a wall.
It's
yeah,
an actual wall.
5 meters high.
Huge thing. Wide. Concrete. There's no getting over it. So if you live in Gaza, you're not allowed to leave. There is no, you know, you can't get a visa unless it's extraordinarily exceptional circumstances. You can't get an exit permit. You can't go anywhere. You are trapped. It's a prison. It is a giant prison. Not only can you not go anywhere, people can't come and see you without authorization, you know, which is why so Israel has often been able to just turn the tap off on journalists going into Gaza. They've also turned the tap off on NGOs going into Gaza. Israel controls what can and cannot be brought into Gaza in terms of products. And there's certain things on that on the banned list that include a lot of medical supplies, a lot of drugs, weird things. But ultimately, the people who live there have no control over what they can and can't do with their own lives. And that is the heart of the problem. There have been a few pictures during the rounds. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, he's been talking about how Israel is under siege from these Palestinian terrorists.
I love the argument that gets bandied about as the first one is Israel has a right to defend itself. And I thought, hang on a second, if I go and steal an apple from a kid, and that kid gets pissed off and throws a stone at me, and I go, well, I have a right to defend myself. That argument kind of falls away.
It kind of falls away.
It kind of falls away. We kind of need to look at the origin of this because. You know, that kid throwing a stone at me, and I'm 6'2" and 100 kilograms, is going to get a PK, right? But you know, like for me to use that defense of, you know, I have a right to defend myself, doesn't really hold water in a situation like that.
This is a slight diversion, but I can, if you would like, tell you the story of how I beat up a kid who threw a stone at me.
Okay, no, I think we've kind of used that analogy to its full extent here. But yeah, you were saying.
So, you know, it's Benjamin Netanyahu is out there saying we're under siege and self-defense and all this, and then there's juxtaposed with pictures of Tel Aviv Beach on a Sunday morning.
Which is an incredibly beautiful city, by the way.
Israel is a lovely country. I could, you know, if I wasn't so disturbed by its politics, I could happily live there. I think it's got a wonderful culture, wonderful history. They've really just built themselves a great country, but at whose expense? And everything that Israel enjoys has come at the expense of rights that Palestinians are not able to enjoy. And that ultimately, for me, is the most poignant thing about all this is it's not about the history. It's not about who did what to who in 1948 and what borders were drawn up in whenever, or what wars were fought. It's about this one group of people that is living the high life at the expense of another group of people who are being oppressed in almost every sense of the word. And I am against oppression, personally. Mm-hmm. I think most people are. And the Israeli-Palestinian situation, it really is as simple as that, ultimately.
And as you rightly say, there is only one side that can solve this. I mean, it's like they need a Nelson Mandela, Kadesa type arrangement where you've got a couple of players who get around the table and who're saying, right, look, what is currently going on cannot go on. It is in no one's interest to do this. We need to make make it happen with, you know, within our own two.
You know, they don't need a Nelson Mandela. You know who they need? They need an F.W. de Klerk. He's a man who I think gets a look at. He's sort of been overlooked by history. And I think that's unfortunate because without him, South Africa would have become violent, because it is so often it's the people who have the violence that have the means to enforce violence. It's them that decide whether situations will be peaceful or not.
It reminds me of a segment that I saw on CNN the other day, and they were praising how surprising it was, and praising Benjamin Netanyahu's resistance to use a lot of force in this conflict. And I was going, this is the resistance, right? This is the minimal force that is available to you. And I was going, holy crap. What were they, what is the extent that they were expecting him? Because he has a sort of right-wing background, had a much more militant stance in his earlier career in politics, right? And he was very vocal about being more militant and using more power, firepower against Palestine.
So what would it look like if he was not exercising restraint?
This is the scary thing, yeah, you know. So terrifying. And they were praising him, and I'm going, holy crap!
Gaza's on the one side, and the West Bank's the other side, and they're not connected to each other. It's this non-contiguous territory. It's weird. But I went to a protest there. I went to a protest there. So there's a group of villagers in the West Bank. Yep. And one of these Israeli settlements, so they keep building new settlements. They're basically annexing territory in the West Bank continuously. One of these settlements had sort of popped up near their village, and the demarcation of the settlement included the village's olive groves and their water supply. So suddenly this village, which had been farming olives for the last few centuries, they had no more trees and no more water to plant the trees they didn't have. So, I mean, their livelihoods were destroyed in an instant. So this was a protest from this village, you know, saying, we want you to move the wall back so we can have our olive groves back. And again, there's a wall that snakes through the West Bank. In this section, it wasn't a physical wall. It was a series of electrified fences. So there were three or four of them. So you couldn't get through, and they were always manned by soldiers. So anyway, so this protest was peaceful. There were no weapons. And it marched towards the electric fence. There was chanting. There was singing. A few teenage boys threw some stones at the Israeli soldiers on the other side. Now, they were far on the other side. You couldn't reach them with the stones. And besides that, Palestinians cannot throw. Like, I reckon Jonty Rhodes could really make a successful career out of training Palestinian terrorists to throw stones better. Now, anyway, so this was the extent of the protest. And I was there. I had my camera. I was taking pictures. And suddenly, the tear gas comes raining down. The rubber bullets come out. And it's tear gas in those situations. It's really terrifying. It sounds like a mortar coming. Yeah. And there's little, you know, there's either the mortar tear gas or there's the grenades. Yeah. It was, you know, they really reacted very harshly to this peaceful protest. And I've always wondered to myself, what if instead of sending down the tear gas, because, I mean, these guys, there were no threat. There was electrified fencing. There was,
kids.
I mean, come on. There were no threat. So what if instead of sending down the tear gas and the rubber bullets, they just lobbed cold cans of Coke over the fence? I mean, it was a hot day. Just throw a few cans of Coke and say, here, guys, have a drink.
Yeah.
Suddenly, that would take the sting out of it completely. But this overzealous response, it's almost self-perpetuating, because almost every, you know, there's been some research that shows that people who commit acts of terrorism almost always do so because they feel, you know, there've been some act of violence committed against them or their family. You know, their uncle has been locked up for no reason. Their mother was shot in the back of the head by police. Their job was taken away when, you know, some politician came and gave it to his nephew. These are the things that start terrorism. So the more brutal you are, the bigger the backlash is going to be. And I think Israel is almost encouraging this with its current actions. It is breeding the next generation of anti-Israel violence right now. And that is the most, the most serious. This is a long-term thing. Even when this quietens down, we've got to deal with the long-term implications of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think what is quite clear here is that the approach that has been ongoing for the last 70-odd years isn't working. Something different needs to happen. And maybe Coca-Cola is the solution. And maybe the lobbying of a couple of Coca-Cola cans is the solution to the problem. But, I mean, that's the fundamental shift in approach. You know, not using violence to get the message across, using, you know, as you say, the FW de Klerk, the Nelson Mandela's, the, you know, the Cyril Ramaphosa's and, you know, the guys who led negotiations when the Chris Hani's of the world were being assassinated and things could have gone completely, you know, awry. And it didn't, because there were people who were committed to the peace process. And that just seems to be what's lacking here. And maybe it is from both sides, you know, but I think the olive branches need to be extended to show and to get, you know, to get things moving in that direction.
I agree. I mean, I'm under no illusions that if the roles were reversed and it was the Palestinians who had their territory and the Israelis in the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinians, I'm sure, would be just as bad. The enmity is so deep-rooted that you can't just solve it overnight. That's what John Kerry discovered earlier this year when he went to make peace in the Middle East. And look where that's got us.
Okay, so we're going to move to some South African news, which has been a little bit quiet, I think, of late. I mean, the world affairs have sort of dominated the headlines, and South Africa's sort of been sort of scandal quiet for a little bit, which is quite surprising. On the line from Cape Town, we've got the beautiful and talented Rebecca Davis. Rebecca?
Hello, Steely. How are you?
Always good to speak to you. As we were saying, it seems to be a bit of a slow news cycle in South African current affairs at the moment.
No, I must break in there, Stu. It's actually the most frantically busy one.
Really?
I think it's just that you know, these international developments have overshadowed it a bit. But the fact, for instance, that over last week and this week, we've seen the ministers present all their plans for what they're going to do with our money for the year, but in such quick succession that it's been almost impossible for journalists to keep up with. As Ranjini Munasamy wrote on the Daily Maverick last week, it's just been this complete whirlwind of information, and GCIS, the government communication systems, has clearly been struggling to keep pace, as have journalists, because normally the budget vote debates, where the ministers lay out their plans, take place over several weeks, even months. And this year, because elections screwed everything up in terms of timing, they've had to condense it into a two-week period. So actually what's coming out is hugely significant in some regards, because obviously it's vital to keep track of what ministerial plans are, and yet it's been very, very difficult to keep track of it.
What are the key things that have emerged so far?
What are the key things?
Yeah.
Well, look, there have been, I mean, good news and bad news, sort of. There have been a lot of kind of concrete ideas for what's going to happen, and a lot of kind of negative revelations about what has happened with our money. So, for instance, Public Works' announcement last week, for instance, that they'd been paying rent of up to, I think, 70 million rand a year for government properties which turned out not to have anyone living in them, obviously quite distressing, and the fact that they'd also been putting the bill for a number of other government properties, again coming to over a million rand a month, that didn't have government tenants living in them. So this means that the government has just completely failed to properly audit what they own and who lives in it, obviously isn't a particularly positive demonstration of what's going on. Another pretty significant development, I think, is Housing Minister Lindiwe Sisulu's indication that the era of free housing may actually be coming to an end. And we heard Lindiwe Sisulu in her budget vote speech last week sort of rail against what she called the culture of entitlement when it comes to housing in this country. She said that on looking at the housing list, she was sort of distressed and amazed to see how many 18-year-olds, for instance, believe they are entitled to a free house, indicated that South Africa simply isn't keeping pace, that the housing provision has dropped hugely, I think up to 25% in some provinces over the last 5 years. And the issue is simply that urbanization is happening too quickly. Too many South Africans want to move into cities, and there just isn't enough land. And that's obviously a very thorny problem that we're going to deal with. But, you know, also some more positive developments coming out of it. I thought Correctional Services announcement, for instance, that they will be making it a lot easier for the victims of crimes families to participate in parole board hearings by instituting video conferencing at all parole board centres by November. I mean, that's a really interesting positive development, especially since we saw 2 weeks ago how Eugene de Kock's parole application mm-hmm. was denied on the basis of that exact point. And the Minister Janus Michael...
Wallace. And the Janus Wallace parole...
quite, exactly. And Correctional Services Minister Michael Masuta admitted last week that currently only 5% of victims' families are being consulted about parole in these cases, either because they live too far away or because of language barriers. So that's one of the more positive things. Also, some good news about general expenditure, for instance, that the Department of Arts and Culture, which we'll talk a bit more about mm-hmm. now, is going to be spending upwards of $50 billion, I think, on libraries. So they are embarking on a huge drive to institute new public libraries around the country, which will also be fitted with internet connections and computers, and they will be stocking them with books, which I think we can all agree is a pretty good use of public funds for once.
I've always wondered about the role of the library in modern-day society, and obviously slightly different in South Africa. I mean, we have our challenges here. We have, access to the internet is obviously one of the biggest challenges. The role of the library in modern society, are they just going to fall by the wayside? Is the use, the utility of these places going to just sort of, disappear? Or are they going to evolve? What does the future library look like that's going to be useful to people to go and use them in the past as we did before the age of the internet?
I think if you go into libraries in the UK, for instance, these days, Steely, you'll see that a lot of people are using them more for their computer facilities than for books, that people know it's a place where they can go online for free and apply for jobs, do their CVs and so forth. But look, in a country like South Africa, where even though internet penetration is spreading, the uptake of e-books, for instance, is very low, as we know. I don't think that there's going to be any substitute for what libraries can offer, particularly given the exorbitant price of physical books in this country for quite a while, particularly when it comes to schools in rural or impoverished areas.
The Departments of Art and Culture tabled their budget in Parliament last week as well. And there was an interesting, development in there and a piece that you picked up on.
That's right. And that was the news that the department is going to be spending 34 million rands, a fairly substantial whack of what isn't a huge budget for that ministry, on outfitting South African schools with a flag. They want to see every South African school have a flag and a flagpole, and they aim to do this by the end of the financial year. Now, I was interested in this because it struck me as being sort of vaguely familiar sounding. And when I did some research, I found out that actually this project has been in place since 2005. So for the past 9 years, they've been working on this a flag in every school campaign. What's interesting to me is how minimal the success has been thus far, yet how large the sums budgeted have been. So when it was first announced by the then Arts and Culture Minister, Paula Jordan, in 2005, he said they were budgeting 10 million rand for that purpose over the 2005-2006 financial year. But a later Treasury report from 2008 on the arts and culture budget says that no flags were put up in 2005. I think one flag was put up in 2006, none again in 2007. Then suddenly a glut of 2,000 in 2008. But at various other points, we've also seen budgeted amounts of 10 million at another point going towards this particular project. Now, I'm not saying that this money was necessarily wasted or something untoward happened to it. It could just be that it was budgeted and then not spent.
Yeah, well, you can say that. We'll say that it was.
It is interesting to see how unsuccessful it's been thus far and how very slow. I mean, 9 years. There are only, by some estimates, about 22,000 schools in South Africa. And they claim that now they have 7,000 flags up and running, and the rest will be done by the end of this year. But, of course, the wider question is, should we be spending any money at all on putting flags in schools when, as Equal Education's audits of schools have found, there are still over 3,000 schools without running water, without electricity, without libraries, as we were saying, without sports fields at all, without even toilets or fencing? So the question of what will be achieved by running a flag over these incredibly run-down schools is really open to question, I think.
I think the optimal situation is to actually have working toilets and facilities and libraries and a flag. I think it would be quite nice to have a flag, but in the absence of those other facilities, I don't think the flag really makes my top three in terms of the things you really need to have in a school.
No, and perhaps not even top 20. You know, I spoke to Eco Education Deputy General Secretary Doran Isaacs about this last week, and he actually suggested that it's almost an insult to the flag as well as to the schools and to the learners when you have these schools without any decent facilities, yet a shiny flag running over them. What is that saying? And it's also interesting that this is definitely part of this move we're seeing in recent weeks towards the need for South Africans to be more patriotic. This seems to be coming out of government a lot at the moment. I don't know if it's something they're discussing in cabinet meetings a lot or what. But first we saw one of the ANC MPs suggesting that the national anthem should be played twice a day. We've seen SABC CEO Claudia Motsoeneng say that we need more patriotic journalism, and he too has reinforced the importance of the anthem. So there's clearly something going on in government, which is quite interesting to think about, why they think South Africans at the moment in particular are lacking in patriotism and why they place such importance on it in the first place.
It's kind of like using polyfiller to fill up the Grand Canyon, it seems.
It is, in light of all our far more intractable social problems. But I think perhaps their reasoning is that patriotism is one of the building blocks to social cohesion, another buzzword we're hearing a lot of these days, to nation building, and that if South Africans can start being more patriotic, then, I don't know, crime levels will go down, racial relations will improve, and people will just start being nice to each other. But I think that's a tenuous link at best.
Bex, I've got a question for you. Going back to what you said earlier, so there's a city in America, and I forget which one it is, I read the story this morning, but basically some journalist filed a freedom of information request, or whatever the equivalent there is, and they wanted a specific bit of data, and the city said, okay, we'll give you this data. So they gave them the data buried in a spreadsheet that was sort of 700 pages long, and they didn't give them the spreadsheet, they gave them a PDF. So they basically, they flooded them with so much information that it became impossible to find the little bit that they needed. Do you think, in light of government just flooding you with all this information, flooding us with all this information, is there a similar dynamic, do you think? Do you think that we're going to miss important things because we're not getting it bit by bit, we're getting it all at once?
That's very interesting. And that technique you talk of coming out of that American story is, time honored. This is an acknowledged trick on behalf of government. They will give data in that format. And if you go on kind of modern data journalism courses and so forth, they give you all sorts of tricks to try and extract data and to search for it by using, PDF prefixes and Excel suffixes, and so forth. My thoughts, Simon, when I realized what is going on in Parliament, which I think a lot of people haven't, was to wonder if there was something sinister about it, to be quite frank, because, it just doesn't seem to serve our interests as a public at all. And as Ranjini pointed out, it is one of the guiding principles of the government communication service that they have to provide the necessary information to the public in a way that clearly isn't happening at the moment. But I am told, in fact, by a DA MP who would have every incentive to stress a sinister element, that there isn't actually anything untoward about it. It is simply because the timing of this year has worked out in a way that there is no other opportunity in the parliamentary schedule but for them to squeeze it all in like this. But it's a huge problem, I think. I really think it's a tremendous pity.
Well, Rebecca, I just wanted to wrap up and say thanks very much for joining us today. And we'll maybe speak to you next week.
Perfect. Thanks so much, Dillian, Simon.
Cheers, Bex.
Cheers.
Bye. Simon, some interesting developments happening out of Nigeria, Swaziland, and Libya. Let's maybe start with Nigeria.
Yes.
And this $1 billion loan that President Goodluck Jonathan is looking to try and get, or grant, sorry.
Well, you've got to shake your head and wonder at this. So Goodluck Jonathan's got a problem on his hands. We all know this. It's been how many months now? He has still not brung back our girls. It's been however many months he has not managed to do anything to dent the impact of Boko Haram in Nigeria. I think it was Amnesty or Human Rights Watch just released a report that said more than 2,000 people have been killed in Boko Haram attacks this year. 2,000 people. Wow. It's an incredible number for a country that's not at war, for a democracy that's, having elections next year, that's meant to be Africa's largest economy.
I think that's a significant multiple of the death toll we've seen now in Gaza, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to put it into context, it's three or four times, you know, bigger.
So, I mean, there's a proper war going on up there. Now, what good luck Jonathan wants to do is, so he's gone to his parliament and he said, look, the military is underfunded. I don't have enough money to buy the equipment and do the training and do everything I want to do so that we have a fighting fit military who can just defeat this menace. So please, will you authorize me to go cap in hand begging for a $1 billion loan for our military? And Parliament is not sitting at the moment, so this came just before they broke. So it'll be 2 months before he gets permission to do so. Who knows who will he get the money from if he does get this permission? But what worries me more is that, yes, more resources need to be directed towards the fight against Boko Haram. They really are a violent and brutal group, and they are making life impossible in northern Nigeria. But is the military the best tool to do this with? Now, we look over the last
three or four years, the Nigerian military.
Well, any military, really, still. If you think about it, you know, America, what, probably the finest military force in the world. It has spent decades in the Middle East fighting in Iraq, fighting in Afghanistan to try and stop Al-Qaeda, you know. And sure, they killed bin Laden, but they didn't stop Islamist extremism. They just bred more. And the threat from Islamist extremism today is greater than it was prior to 9/11. So I think that has failed. It may have prevented attacks within the USA, all the extra security stuff. But I don't know. I tend to go for a more global perspective. And that's not an option for Nigeria anyway, because the attacks are, you know, the groups are based in their own country. So now, over the last 3 or 4 years, there have been multiple military crackdowns on Boko Haram. There have been, you know, horrendous human rights abuses committed by the military, you know, summary executions, massacres, all in the name of pursuing Boko Haram. You know, these guys that they shoot in the back of the head, are they militants, as the military likes to say they are, or are they just guys who happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time? It's really hard to know. And you got to know that the guy who does get shot in the head, his brothers, his cousins, his relatives are all suddenly going to be a lot more inclined towards supporting Boko Haram. And it might not mean they become militants themselves, but it might mean that they turn a blind eye when they see something dodgy going on. And groups like this cannot exist without some level of goodwill from the local population. It's not like they have 500 fighters and that's it. They have a big operation. They have some members, but they also have a lot more people who are not turning them in, who are not reporting them, whether that's through fear or whether that's through sympathy. You know, that dynamic exists. So my recommendation, if I was the president of Nigeria, thank God that I'm not, and someone gave me $1 billion to fight Boko Haram, I'd split it in half, probably, and I'd pursue two very different routes. The first would be I'd actually bolster the police, because really some of these things, there's a political situation with Boko Haram, but there's also a simple criminal element, and that criminal element is attacks and suicide bombings, etc., as well as organized crime. A lot of these militant groups fund themselves through various criminal activities such as human trafficking, drug trafficking, etc. So what I'd do is expand the police, train the police, and then I'd try and prosecute people through the criminal justice network. Use the laws that exist, the laws of the country, and do it properly. Make sure when you sentence someone that they are guilty. Even if this means that you don't get everyone. It's slow. It's not going to stop the attacks in the very short term, but I don't think anything will. But in the long term, it prevents further radicalization of the movement. It prevents a longer-term problem. Aligned with that, I take the other money, and I would drastically invest in northern Nigeria, which historically has really been almost criminally neglected by a series of Nigerian governments.
Because of the lack of mineral resources and oil, notably.
Yes, and just the political dynamics of Nigeria. So Nigeria has been ruled by southern politicians for much of its history. And even when the northern politicians have been in charge, the jaw of Lagos as the big city, I think, just tends to suck infrastructure funding and government interest and all that kind of thing. So there really is a systemic inequality is what really underpins this. Now, of course, we're not going to solve this in a couple of years, but someone needs to be thinking about solving this problem in 30 years' time.
And if you don't start now, well, you know, it's
exactly.
We're never going to get any closer.
So the statistics are shocking. Like something like girls in northern Nigeria, 5% are literate, compared to 90% in southern Nigeria. I mean, that tells you something is very drastically wrong there. And those kinds of inequality, that is a fertile breeding ground for extremist ideology. If extremist ideology is present, you know, then it will take root when the conditions are like that. If you take away those conditions, it really takes away the foundation stone for those kind of ideologies to prosper.
It's also interesting that you mentioned the investment in police rather than the military as well, because thinking about it, a more visible police presence is very different to a more visible military presence. I mean, if you see, you know, if you had to see policemen walking in the streets, it's a very different reality of seeing, you know, the military walking around, you know, down Sandy Drive. You know, it's there's a very different.
You know, when you see a soldier brought out for a protest or something, you know, you cuck yourself because you know it's serious. Yeah. You know, they don't come for the small stuff. So it just immediately escalates the tensions and make things more serious than they are.
A little closer to home, you wrote a piece, I think it was yesterday, about Swaziland, and something is rotten in the state of Swaziland.
Oh, something is so very, very rotten. This is a, you know, it's just another in a long litany of stories from Swaziland that are just, they're outrageous. The stuff that King Mswati gets away with and that we as South Africans allow him to get away with.
Well, that's the question. What is, you know, what is our government doing? What are they saying, you know, with, first of all, what happened?
So this story is, there were two journalists. One is the editor of a paper. One's actually a human rights lawyer, but he also writes some articles. And they wrote a couple of stories a few months ago about the Chief Justice of Swaziland. Now, the Chief Justice, weirdly, is actually from Lesotho, which is a problem in terms of the country's constitution. And he's meant to be stepping aside to make way from someone from Swaziland, but he hasn't. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was another judge's car had been stopped by a policeman. And this policeman, you know, asked to see the plates, asked to see the authorization, etc.
Where are your papers?
Exactly. And this, you know, this car didn't have the papers. So this judge was in the back, his driver was in the front, and the car didn't have the papers. So the policeman did this crazy thing and wrote up a fine.
Did his job.
He did his job. The Chief Justice was unimpressed. Don't you know, you don't mess with judges, okay? And he booked this officer for contempt of court and said, you're disrespecting the judiciary. And so these two journalists wrote about this and said, well, this is crazy. You know, we can't have this renegade Chief Justice running around and arresting people just for doing their jobs. And sure enough, they got arrested themselves. And last week, I think it was, that they were convicted for contempt of court, which carries with it a 3-month sentence. One of them had received a similar conviction in similarly dubious circumstances, so he's looking at even longer jail time. But it really is, you know, it's even as Swaziland goes, this is not a particularly remarkable story. It gets more attention because it involves journalists, and journalists, you know, we're like a brotherhood. There's like this code between us that if you mess with a journalist, we will talk about it.
Well, and we saw in Egypt,
yes, exactly.
You know, the conviction of the journalist, the Al Jazeera journalist in Egypt, and you know, international outrage at there, but not so much coming out of South Africa.
No, we stay very quiet with Swaziland. We like good relations with all our neighbors, be it Zimbabwe or Swaziland or anyone else, and we have a very muted foreign policy, is what I've discovered. You know, it's meant to be based on these wonderful ideals, and you read that paper Nelson Mandela wrote. I think it was for Foreign Affairs magazine. We outlined the foreign policy of the new South Africa, and it was going to be looking out for our fellow man in the spirit of Ubuntu and protecting human rights, etc., etc. None of that has happened in the real world, you know. And sure, diplomacy is real politics. You know, you got to be careful who you piss off, who you criticize, and sometimes that can be for the greater good. when it comes to Swaziland, I feel we are in a position of power.
Well, this is the strangest thing. I mean, in a way, you can almost understand when, let's say, the Dalai Lama wants to come to South Africa and his visa application gets lost and, you know, all sorts of bureaucratic BS that goes around that. And, you know, you're not wanting to piss off the Chinese because the Chinese are a big economic player on the continent. But in this respect, it's kind of like, you know, really, you know, why should we be wary of Swaziland?
My working theory is that we've got a few skeletons in our own closet. And suddenly, if we were going to go make a big deal about abuse of power and corruption in Swaziland, well, then everyone else has the right to come and make a big deal about abuse of power and corruption in South Africa. Yeah. And this is dangerous ground for our current government.
So you're saying we're living in a big glass house at the moment?
We're living in a very big glass house.
With very thin windows, it would seem. Quickly, in Libya, we've seen basically what it sounds like is that the country is being run by militia.
It is. There is a government.
In the loosest sense of the word.
In the loosest sense of the word. And you wonder what qualifies you to be a government. Why is this guy the prime minister? Who appointed him? Well, no one really appointed him. He was just he's still an interim prime minister. The government itself doesn't control any of the main institutions. You know, he doesn't control the airport now. Well, he hasn't. The government, it's always been in the hands of one militia. So they don't control anything of importance. No one seems to listen to any decisions that they make. So why are they the main sort of entryway into Libya? So the international community pretty much exclusively deals with the government itself, yet they're not pulling the strings. So maybe we should be thinking about dealing with the people who are pulling the strings.
And some crazy situation where the government is relying on militia to defend territories and key points.
Well, this is a common problem, and exactly the same thing happened in Iraq. And of course, no one ever learns the lessons. So you have a revolution or a change of government. In Iraq, they overthrew Saddam, and then they disbanded the army because the army was Saddam's, you know, the weapon of control. And you can understand the need to do that. You know, you want to get rid of these guys who've been oppressing you for so long. But what happens then? A, you've got a whole bunch of people who are well-trained and have weapons without a job. That's never a good combination of factors. No. The second thing is you're a government, and you don't have any guys with weapons to look out for your own interests. So suddenly, you're vulnerable. What do you do when you're vulnerable? Well, you find some guys with weapons.
Yeah.
And suddenly, these ragtag militias, you know, maybe they're renegade units from the army, or maybe they are religiously organized militant groups. Suddenly, they come in to protect that government in power. But who's, you know, if they've got the guns, who's really in control? You know, are they going to listen when you say stop? Are they going to listen when the government says, no, we don't need you anymore? You can go off to whatever hole you came out of. Probably not.
You know, when you look at, so obviously you focus your efforts and your research and your reporting on the African continent, and you're probably in a best place to answer this question. I look around and I see the news reports coming out of the continent and generally not really sunshine journalism and good news that seems to be coming out of the continent. And, you know, there are troubles, it seems like, any which way you look, and obviously, you know, extending into the Ukraine on the surface. But what are the shining lights on the continent? Which are the countries that are doing things right, that are doing things that we should be looking to? Hey, wow, you know, why aren't we implementing some of those things in at home in South Africa that we could actually say, you know, those are inspiring stories to
Well, there's to a really the interesting dynamic, and there's two distinct streams, we'll call them. We'll call them the economic success stories and the political success stories. So politically, you've got quite a few countries now who have elections. They have really healthy democracies. They have governments who lose elections and gracefully hand over power to the next guy. I mean,
crazy stuff.
You know, Ghana's a great example of this. Zambia is another excellent example of this. And
how is our sick president doing?
Oh, who knows?
Still
keeping a very low profile. But then you have the economic success stories. And here I'm thinking particularly of Ethiopia and Rwanda. Now, both countries are ruled in a very authoritarian way. There's very tight restrictions on political rights, but those
countries and on the freedom of the press as well.
Yes, but they are delivering socioeconomic rights. So we have this weird situation in Africa at the moment where countries are almost making a choice. They're saying, well, do we want political rights or do we want socioeconomic rights? Do we want wealth or do we want freedom? These are the sort of questions being asked. And so far, there hasn't really been a country that's succeeded in merging the two, except for us. South Africa is, you know, for all our problems, we're still a very healthy democracy. We're still a very healthy economy. We've got way more money and way more rights than most other African countries. So we're doing well. But in general, it's hard to see anyone else who is an example. And South Africa is not an example because we have such a strange and unique history that it's not really a model that other countries can look to follow. So in short, it's a tricky one. If you're a president of an African country, you've got some really tough decisions to make, and you're going to piss off somebody, whatever decision you make.
On that, I know there was an index that was released last week that ranked the cities around the world in terms of which are the most affordable to live in for American expatriates, and which is great, using the assumptions that you are an expat living in one of these countries, receiving a dollar salary, and then living in these cities. And interestingly enough, there was a city, I think, was either right at the top or near the top, was Luanda, which is notoriously expensive. Following this oil, it seems to be the oil rush in Angola has catapulted cost of living prices, and that seems to be, you know, what's driving that there. But then also another bunch of a couple of African cities made it onto the list quite high up, but for different reasons. And that was the fact that in order to maintain the same lifestyle that you had in, you know, in America, for example, to live that same lifestyle in these other cities was just so expensive. You know, to live in the suburbs that, you know, or offered that X, Y, and Z that you were used to home, and because of the lack of infrastructure and resources and developed economies and access to those services, it was really more really expensive for those places. So kind of a little bit almost counterintuitive. You think they're kind of like in the middle of nowhere, life can't really be that expensive, but it's to live
It is, and I find it reporting as well. So when I go traveling to places, you know, you can stay pretty cheaply in Nairobi and Uganda and Egypt and stuff. But if you want to go to DRC, wow, you need serious bucks. If you want to go to Central African Republic, you need even more, because the stuff you need just doesn't exist. So you got to pay through the nose for it. If you want a driver, if you want a car, you're looking at hundreds and hundreds of dollars a day. It's just crazy. It's this weird false economy.
And you're always a little bit wary of using your credit card in some places. Yes. Okay. Simon, thanks so much for joining us today, joining me today in the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I was your host, Stilly Cherilambos. We're with you every Tuesday afternoon at 1 o'clock on Cliff Central. Please do join us again next week.
CliffCentral.com.